A few months back, SNO showed a film on climate change. I know some of you were there because I recognize you. It'd been produced by a group in Owen Sound. The main speaker divided the Canadian population into four groups. I got a nice little pie graph up there for you. Now I'm going to simplify the numbers that he gave. I'm going to provide a headline of each group as I understood it. I'm pretty confident I'm staying close to the material of the film, although if you don't think I am, let me know. There are four groups in Canadian society, the speaker said, with respect to climate change. The first group, who makes up about 10% of the population, are those who understand climate change as the problem for the world. I'm sure the world has many problems, for sure, but in this 10% of the population, this is the overall existential crisis that we face as a world. The second group of about 30% of the population understands climate change as a big problem for the world. Further, 30% of the population understands climate change as a problem for the world. And the fourth group of about also 30% of the population understands climate change as no problem for the world. Which group would you place yourself in? If you had to assign yourself one of the four categories, which one is closest to you? The problem, a big problem, no problem. If we put ourselves on a continuum from 0 to 100, and I got a slide there for that as well, with 0 being the understanding that there is absolutely no problem with respect to climate change for life on the planet, and 100 being climate change is an impending cataclysmic disaster for life on the planet, where would you put yourself on the continuum? And because even within those four basic groups, there's probably some degree of gradation. I'd be really curious to take a poll of the congregation and plot your views on a graph and see where the middle point of Trillium is. I think it would be totally fascinating to see the distribution of results. I wonder what that distribution would look like. I'm sure we could do that on any issue for that matter, on abortion, capital punishment, should NATO intervene in Ukraine. I'm sure we could plot the distribution on a graph, see where the middle point of the congregation is. What about COVID? New regulations come into effect March 21st that take away mandatory masking for indoor gatherings. How does Trillium respond to this new set of realities? Do we unmask at our next Sunday service on March 27th, or do we delay a few weeks or a few months before we do that? Where on the continuum would you be in your thinking about this? At Trillium, one of our core values is embrace diversity. There are many forms of diversity in life. Race, ethnicity, language, body shape, education, sex, gender, class, hair color. I think ideological diversity is by far the hardest form of diversity to embrace. See, because we're talking about people's take on life. We're talking about your take on life. We're talking about how you see the world, how people see the world. It's surprising how defensive we can be when others see the world differently than we do. How does a community like Trillium hold cohesion when in many ways the members within it see the world in very different terms? We probably have people in Trillium in all four different categories of understanding with respect to climate change. How does a community like ours manage that kind of diversity? There are two fundamentally opposed ways to seeing the war in Ukraine. One of the ways doesn't even use the term war. In Russia, if you call what's going on in Ukraine a war, you could end up in jail for up to 15 years. For treason, for spreading false news, which is treasonous to them. I was listening to two European economists who are musing that perhaps the West had gone too far in their sanctions on Russia. Now, if you were a Ukrainian nationalist or you were sympathetic to Ukraine in the ongoing war, you would find perhaps these economists' words traitorous. Are they traitors for musing such a thing? Anthony Flew was a world-leading philosopher. I don't know how many of you have ever heard of him, but he was a world-leading philosopher, like at the very top, top two or three world philosophers. He was also a committed atheist. Yet at the end of his life, he converted to deism. He was a deist. He came to believe that there must be some prime mover that got everything going. He said his life was a commitment to following the evidence, and the evidence had now led him to believe that a strictly naturalistic interpretation for the beginning of the universe or for the first life on the planet was simply impossible. Probabilistically implausible is what he said. And in the atheistic community, there was great disappointment in this development. One of their prime leaders had deserted to the other side. He was perceived by many as a traitor. These moments cut to the core. They have real power because they speak to how we see the world around us. As many of you have probably noted, there seems to be two fundamentally different ways of seeing the world down in the United States, you know, Republican and Democrat. They're opposed to each other on so many specific areas. I'm sure there are lots of people in between these two opposing views, but these two particular views dominate the conversation in the States because we take our frame on life very seriously, especially when we're obviously on one side of the divide or the other. One of the hardest places in life to be in is when your take on life, that is your ground level philosophy, how you see and understand the world around you, the frame that you look at life through, when that frame stops working for you. That's a very scary place to be. How do you make sense of things then? It's a place that the Apostle Paul knew very well. As a young man, he saw the world as a Pharisee. That is, he was one devoted to the law as written in the Old Testament, in Jewish terms, the Tanakh. He was super zealous for the traditions. For Paul, there was no compromise to be with this new Jewish interpretation called the Way that later became Christianity. The Way was an alternate way of understanding Jewish traditions, Jewish religious traditions that was built around Jesus, Messiah. Paul was so committed to his Pharisaical training and the worldview that came out of it that he made it his business to persecute those who followed the Way, those earliest Christians. In fact, he was on his way to Damascus in order to continue this persecution of the Way to make sure that he could stamp out this heretical sect, this different way of understanding Judaism, when he was confronted by Jesus. And in this confrontation, his worldview was shattered. It left him desolate, put him in a time of immense despair. God does not rescue us from these moments. When your way of seeing the world, your understanding of life is shattered or stretched or torn, mangled, when it gets cracked, God does not take this moment from you or me. Understand, it can go both ways. Sometimes the challenge of the moment shatters our understanding of God, and that can lead people to losing their faith. Paul was sent by Jesus out into the Gentile world to bring the gospel love to all people, to all people. One might have thought that his mission, a commission of sorts, would be enthusiastically embraced by a thirsty and hungry world. One might have thought that his proclamation of Jesus Christ raised from the dead would be joyfully welcomed. But people generally don't like their worldviews being challenged. Nobody does. In many ways, it had been a real slog for Paul. He had met so much resistance all along the way. It had been a hard walk for him and his compatriots. In fact, he says this, it was so bad, we didn't think we were going to make it. We felt like we'd been sent to death row, that it was all over for us. The challenge of the resistance to the message he had been given might have made Paul question what he was doing. Is this really God's will for me? Why would it be so hard then if it was God's will? It might have elicited times a feeling of despair for him, moments of deep discouragement, a loss of heart. Paul says that one of the consequences of the hard journey was that it forced him to hand over the mission that God had given him, required him to hand that mission back to God. He says this, instead of trusting in our own strength or wits to get out of it, we were forced to trust God totally. Not a bad idea, since he's the God who raises the dead. In that handing back of the mission, Paul had another shift in his world view. His frame of understanding got powerfully changed again for another time. He says of the hard journey, as it turned out, it was the best thing that could have happened. Forced Paul to completely rely on God. It required Paul not to judge the moment because he didn't have all the information at hand. He didn't have the information he needed to understand what was happening to him. He certainly experienced doors being shut, literally, to him as he was placed in prison. But he just didn't know where those doors would be opened for him in the future. And so he had to place his future into God's hands. He had no choice but to surrender his future into God's care or recant what he had been sent to do. The hard journey became a blessing for him, he says. It required that he change his take on things. For one thing, a hard journey in life is not a sign of being God-forsaken. That's a big shift in understanding when you think about it. I've met many people who have lost their faith because of the tragic life circumstances they have gone through. The tragedy of their circumstances had changed their way of seeing things. Their take on life had been changed by the tragic circumstances, and it meant no place anymore for faith. For Paul to endure the hardship, he had to change his way of seeing the world, had to change his way of understanding how God works in people's lives. If you read 2 Corinthians at the beginning, this conversation is part of a celebration for Paul. He begins the second letter to the church in Corinth with a sense of enthusiasm, excitement. He had endured the hard circumstances. He says that God got him through, rescued him from certain doom. And he was convinced that God would do it again, because he had seen it time and time and again in his own life. And he was convinced that this truth didn't just belong to him, it belonged to all people. What Paul recognized was that the same power that raised Jesus from the dead was at work in his life. It was the same power. Sometimes we can imagine that God has different kinds of power. The power God might manifest in my life is a lot different from the power that raised Jesus from the dead. What Paul came to understand, no, it's the same power. The power that raised Jesus from the dead was the one that got him through the hard journey. That's the promise given to us in the resurrection of Jesus. It's one power, and it can open doors for us. It's the same power that raised Jesus, and it can open doors for us in life. Even the door to death can be opened for us by its presence. Paul learned through his missionary work in those years never to let the sense of past failure defeat your next step. It would have been so easy for him to just give up. In the hard journey, it's so easy to just give up. It's easy to imagine that it's always going to be hard. The journey is always hard. In our frame of understanding, we often extrapolate from past experience into our present or future life. I had a friend of mine who was betrayed in his marriage. His wife left him for another person. He became very sour on women. He made sweeping statements like women are not trustworthy. His tragedy shaped his understanding of life, condemned him to a life of bitterness, sadness, and loneliness. It led to what I think was a faulty interpretation, because there are innumerable women of character in the world. It's inevitable we will come to places of disillusionment and despair. It's part of our human experience. We've all had that experience of being disillusioned or experiencing despair. It's often based on real life events in our lives. Sometimes we might even find ourselves in places we can't lift ourselves out of. What are we to do in those moments? How are we to understand them? How are we to interpret them, act in them? There are times when we have a sense of doing something irreversible in life, or something comes upon us and overwhelms us, and we say to ourselves, well, it's all over now. It's all over and ruined now. What's the point in trying anymore? When we say that sort of thing, when we all say that at times, it's something we say, I think everyone has said it, that we're allowing the pain and disillusionment of life in the moment to shape our worldview and define our take on life. And that's not what Paul was sent out into the world to proclaim. That's not what God revealed to him in Jesus Christ. That's not what Paul was sent to teach people. He was sent to teach people that it's not over until God is finished. Not when the world says it's over. It's over when God says it's over. And right now we're watching a tragedy unfold in Ukraine, a nation of people being ground down to nothing. And my greatest fear is that the Russians will simply pulverize Ukraine into rubble and then leave, leaving a destroyed people behind. Ukrainians, I'm sure, I've listened to enough of them on the news, and a lot of other people on the outside are wondering if Ukraine can make it. It's almost as if people have been sentenced to death row. Ukraine as a country has been sentenced to death row, that in many ways it seems it's over for them, just like it was for Paul. What will history say about Ukraine? Is this the end? Or is it the beginning? It's a hard path that they are on for sure, but where will it lead for them? The future in part depends on the worldview being shaped in the Ukrainian people in this catastrophe. What lessons are they learning from this time of incredible trial? See, the real enemy, their real enemy, is despair. There's no physical force that can beat them. The Russians don't have enough firepower to totally crush them unless the people themselves fall into a despair that is unending. Perhaps the circumstances that the people of Ukraine are in will lead them as a nation to trust God totally with their future. Maybe they'll have no choice but to do this. No matter the trials of the moment, standing with confidence and that God will lead them through, maybe that's their way forward ultimately. I'm certainly praying that ultimately we will be able to look back and say that this was Ukraine's finest hour, when as a people they stepped up in the hardest place and met the test of the moment with courage and conviction. And we shouldn't lose sight of Paul's final thought in the passage that Diane read. He says to the Corinthian church that it was in part their prayers that were part of the rescue operation. It was their prayers that got them through. It was their prayers that got Paul and his companions through the time of darkness. Paul says, I can see your faces even now lifted in praise for God's deliverance of us. A rescue in which your prayers played such a crucial part. It's tempting, and seeing the trials of others, to fall into such a despair that we stop praying for them. To feel that their hard circumstances can overrule God's way in life. Let's not let another's despair teach us the wrong lesson in the moment either. Let's pray with all we have and all we are in their deliverance. Let's pray for Ukraine constantly. And let's pray for anyone or any people who find themselves confronted by the power of this world. Let's pray for anyone who's tested by the violence of this world. Let's pray for them and for us to never give up hope in the coming victory of God, in the power of God's holy love. The power of God's holy love that raises the dead. And who, a power that's with us today and forever. I think our ground level philosophy as followers of Jesus, our ground level philosophy, our basic take on life, our view that we see life through commonly as a church gathered to celebrate Jesus' presence is this: Jesus Christ crucified and raised from the dead.